Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The presidential primaries have produced record turnout for Republicans and higher than usual turnout for Democrats. This is according to the Pew Research Center. For the GOP, it's the highest turnout since 1980. And for the Democrats, aside from the near record-breaking 2008 primaries, it's the highest turnout since 1992. But if we break down the numbers, only 17% of eligible Republicans and just 11% of eligible Democrats have voted. While primary election turnout tends to be lower than general elections, overall voter turnout has never reached the high it did back in 1900, when almost 74% of eligible voters went to the polls. And if we look at the 2014 midterms, voter turnout plunged to the lowest level in 72 years. So what explains this? From defining who can and cannot vote to money in politics, the history of voting has been fraught with battles. In his new book, The Fight to Vote, today's guest, Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, writes, quote, "During the first century that followed independence, American democracy had expanded as the right to vote became a core element of national identity. The next decades reversed that trend. By the end of the 19th century, American democracy was reeling in retreat," end quote. It took nearly two centuries to expand voting rights from property-owning white men to all of us. Today, the hard-won right vote is still under attack. While some states are expanding access to the polls, including here in California, 17 states have introduced new voting restrictions, ranging from strict voter ID laws to cutting back on early voting. Joining me to talk about this centuries-long battle to protect the right to vote is Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. It's a nonpartisan law and policy institute that works to improve the systems of democracy and justice. His new book is called The Fight to Vote. Michael will be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6:30. You can find information at commonwealth.org or yourcallradio.org. And Michael Waldman joins me in studio. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. So your book is really fascinating. We've done a lot of shows about voting. If you do a news search for voting rights, there are at least a dozen articles with new efforts to suppress the vote, new lawsuits coming out, new rulings saying, oh, well, if you don't have the right ID, you can vote. It is so confusing. Why is it there's such a hodgepodge of rules across this country?
Well, you've described it very well, and it's only going to get more and more that way in all likelihood as we approach November. There'll be hand-to-hand combat in the courts. There'll be things ricocheting around, and it's very hard for people to know what to make of it, and often that very confusion is what causes the lines. And it all goes back to the way we established our country and our democracy from the beginning. We were 13 independent countries, in a sense, 13 states, at the time of the Constitution, and they each had their own system of how to vote. And the Constitution did not create a national voting system and actually didn't refer to there being a right to vote at all. And although they debated who could vote and they were very worried about manipulation of the rules, and that tradition of local rule and sometimes misrule has been one of the things that's plagued us over the years, over the centuries on this. As I describe in the book, we've expanded our democracy, but it's always been a fight. It's always been raw and raucous, very frequently partisan. And as many Americans have had to demand their voice be heard and demand their seat at the table, others have fought just as hard to stop them. And, you know, right now we've got not 50 states, but thousands of counties running these elections. Some do it better than others.
Right. And it's just so confusing. So can you give us more information about why this is allowed?
Well, there are national standards for some things. The Voting Rights Act, for example, which was the strongest civil rights law on the books, was a national law that meant that states with a history of discrimination in voting couldn't make those moves, make those changes without permission from the federal government. There are other things in the Constitution. There are the courts, but a lot of these decisions are made out of sight. Sometimes by malevolent partisans or mischief makers, and sometimes just by well-intentioned local officials who don't know what they're doing necessarily. You might remember the Florida recount of 2000. Mm. A lot of the problem there was an earnest but not terribly competent local election official who designed a ballot thinking she was going to make it easier for the senior citizens of West Palm Beach to vote. That meant they accidentally all voted for the wrong candidate. And that was one of the central factors in the end in the mess that led to basically a tie election in Florida that year.
You have some interesting information. I mean, it's really important to go back to 2000. A lot of people have forgotten about that. Why is 2000 so important to remember?
Well, I think of it as recent, but of course, it's actually not that recent anymore. 2000 was a very close election. Al Gore, the Democratic candidate for president, won a majority of the popular vote, but the Electoral College, one of these antiquated systems that we have that tend to deflect the actual popular vote, the Electoral College came down to Florida, and Florida was basically a tie. And that first night, the television networks called it for one candidate, then for another candidate, and it went to a month-long recount. And it was a crazy system. In the end, the Supreme Court stopped the recount by a 5-4 vote. George W. Bush won by, I think, several hundred votes in Florida, and that gave him the presidency. But what it revealed was that we had a ramshackle way of running elections that was easy to manipulate. And it also gave partisans, especially in the conservative movement, the impetus to try to block other people from voting, to manipulate those rules, because it turned out you could win a presidency that way.
He won by 537 votes. And in your book, this is so important, you write that various technical issues were cited for the rejection of 180,000 ballots in Florida in 2000. But black voters were nearly 10 times more likely than white voters to have their ballots turned away. American University professor Alan Lichtman calculates that if ballots cast by black voters were accepted at around the rates of those cast by white voters, Al Gore would have won Florida by 40,000 votes.
And on top of that, the incredibly unfair system of denying the right to vote to people who had a felony conviction,
right,
which is the strictest in Florida of anywhere in the country. And if you think the criminal justice system is unfair and racially disparate in its impact, which it is, then that plays out in our democracy. And you had things like purges of voters from the rolls that kicked people off the rolls because their name was similar to someone else who wasn't supposed to be able to vote. And what a surprise, that also affected black voters the most. So it was something of an electoral atrocity that year in Florida.
I'm glad you brought up the felon angle, because this deserves more attention. In Florida in 2000, 58,000 alleged felons were purged from the voting rolls. And then the NAACP sued after the election for violating the Voting Rights Act. The Boca Raton-based Database Technologies, this is the company that put this list together, took a look at it again under stricter criteria. They found that 12,000 black voters should not have been labeled felons, 22 times Bush's 537 margin of victory.
And that was the closest election we'd ever had, but it underscored the kind of stakes here. And what's interesting is, you know, I'm asked, is this new? Is this kind of fighting over who can vote new? And it's consequential and it's important, but it isn't new. We've been fighting over this. It's been at the center of our politics from the beginning. And it didn't start last year or in 2000 or 50 years ago in Selma, Alabama. It started really all the way back at the beginning of the country. And at that time, only white men who owned property were allowed to vote. That was the rule. That was the rule sort of sent down from England. It was controversial even then. So first of all, James Madison and the other people who wrote the Constitution were very aware of precisely this kind of manipulation that could happen. They actually thought state legislatures would pass laws to disenfranchise their opponents, just as we've seen recently. There's a provision in the Constitution that people don't know about called the Elections Clause that gives the federal government the power to override state voting rules to block this same kind of manipulation. But this issue of who could vote, even that was something that divided the founders more than I realized. Ben Franklin led a working man's revolt in Pennsylvania in 1776 to write their new constitution and say that they should end the property requirement, that all all white men mostly, could vote even if they were not wealthy. And Ben Franklin said, there's a man who owns a jackass and it's worth $50, so he can vote. Then the jackass dies. The man is wiser, he's older, he has more knowledge of government, but the jackass is dead, so the man cannot vote. So who really has the right of suffrage, the man or the jackass? John Adams, on the other hand, up in Boston, in Massachusetts, he was aghast at this idea of wider voting rights. He said, new claims will arise. Women will demand the right to vote. Lads of 18 will think their interests not sufficiently attended to. They will demand the right to vote. Men who have not a farthing to their name will think themselves worthy of an equal voice in government, and they will demand the right to vote. Adams said there will be no end of it. And that's exactly what happened. This notion of democracy, this notion that government is only legitimate, as the Declaration of Independence said, when there's consent of the governed, took on a life of its own and became this driving force throughout history to expand who had the power.
You write that in drafting the Constitution, Federalists and Anti-Federalists insisted that voting rights were key. Quote, the entire legitimacy of the government rested on the popular consent. In the end, the delegates reject the ideas of limiting the vote to those with property or of including it in the Constitution, any particular defining of the electorate at all. The states would decide. Those that were expanding voting rights could continue to do so. This refusal to set a national standard, any standard, would have lasting consequences, end quote. And here we are.
And at the time, that was sort of the more progressive thing to do, because some of the delegates, remember, the Constitutional Convention was in secret. It was all behind closed doors. We know what they said almost verbatim because James Madison, who was kind of a hypochondriac, quite a nerd, he took like stenographic notes. So it's an amazing thing. You can read them deciding what the Constitution should look like. Behind closed doors, they were really worried about what would happen when the country got overrun with immigrants and factory workers and people from Europe. They knew what was going to happen. They knew it was going to change. And some of the delegates wanted to enshrine the idea that only the wealthy could vote. Others, Franklin and Madison, said, no, let's not do that. But in public, to sell the Constitution, which was very controversial, to the broader American electorate, everybody had to say, what this is really about is the right to vote. Madison said in the Federalist Papers, he said, who are to be the electors of our new government? Not the rich more than the poor, not the learned more than the ignorant, not the haughty heirs of famous names more than the humble sons of unpropitious fortune, or something like that. The body, the electors are to be the great body of the people of the United States. That was the basis on which the Constitution was ratified, although it wasn't the reality then. The first great voting rights victory, ironically, given the politics of today, was on behalf of the angry white working class men when that property requirement was eliminated in the 1820s and the 1830s. And then after that, the next great fight was to enfranchise black men after the Civil War. Many people don't remember or realize that after the Civil War, the right to vote was put in the Constitution, first for African-American men. There was a tremendous flowering of democracy in the South. 90% voter turnout rate among black men. Hundreds of people elected to legislatures, governor, senator, Congress, and then it was crushed by violence, by terrorism, by the Ku Klux Klan, and by cowardice on the part of the North when they sort of threw their hands up and withdrew the army. And, this notion that voting was the key to citizenship, I tell a story in the book about Abraham Lincoln. He was not for voting rights for African Americans. He was actually against it for a long, long time. But the war changed him. The Civil War changed him. And by the end, 1 in 10 Union soldiers was a black man. And he got up 3 days after the surrender at Appomattox and gave his first big speech on Reconstruction, on what he wanted to have happen after the Civil War in the South, from a second floor window in the White House. Lincoln said, you know, I've been criticized because my Reconstruction plans do not enfranchise black men. I now agree with this criticism. I think that we should extend the vote to those who've served in the military and the educated. And actually, in a cabinet meeting, he indicated he was going to go further. One of the listeners, historians tell us, caught the significance of that. John Wilkes Booth was there, and he gasped, "That means citizenship. That is the last speech he will ever give." He tried to get someone to shoot Lincoln on the spot, and when that guy wouldn't do it, Booth vowed to do it, and 2 days later went to Ford's Theater. So this was – they got how important this right to vote was.
Well, and you write that although white candidates dominated in most places in the decade of Reconstruction, between 264 and 324 black men were elected to Congress and state legislatures in the former Confederate states, about one out of six lawmakers. In the South Carolina legislature, black men served as Speaker of the House and led its committees. 18 black men won statewide offices through the South.
And, you know, this has been wiped from our memory banks because very deliberately there was this suppression of the black vote by the end of the 19th century where there were these new laws and constitutions, the Jim Crow era as we know it. There was an almost a complete disenfranchisement of African Americans in the South, and that was the central fact of American politics for decades until my lifetime, till not that long ago. It affected not just the politics of the South, but of the whole country.
Women got the right to vote in 1920. What was the turnout among women back then?
Well, turnout was low when they first won the right to vote. And women weren't used to voting. It's gone up, but it took a while. But what was interesting was that fight to win that vote, you know, we all know it was the 19th Amendment. It was sort of in our school books, but we kind of skip over it. It doesn't seem as dramatic as some of the other fights before or since, but I learned in researching this book, it was every bit as hard-fought and controversial as the other fights. Mm-hmm. And it was a handful of young women. You know, the Seneca Falls Declaration in 1848, that was – we learn about that, and after that, Susan B. Anthony, and there was the idea that women – were pushing for the right to vote. But frankly, not a lot happened for a long time. And it wasn't until 1911, a handful of young women, many of them had been in graduate school in England, came back and said, "We're going to actually do something bold and audacious. We're going to pass a constitutional amendment." And it was everything from a grand voting rights march down Pennsylvania Avenue the day before the presidential inaugural, where the women, 5,000 women, were attacked by 100,000 men. And it received massive publicity, and it was just like Selma to in winning public opinion because of the violence directed against voting rights activists, to picketing 2 years straight at the White House, hunger strikes, running candidates, building a new political party. And only in 1920 was the 19th Amendment ratified and women won the right to vote. And that is an incredible thing. It doubled the size of the electorate in one fell swoop.
There's a great film about the suffrage movement in the UK. We did a show about it. And then there's another good film about what happened here in the United States called Iron-Jawed Angels.
I liked it, but it was so hallucinatory. I loved the punk rock soundtrack. But you couldn't tell what was real or what wasn't real, in my view. And so there were all these things in that HBO movie, and then I read the history books, and they turned out to be true. And I thought that they were something the scriptwriters had made up. So Keira Knightley was in that. It was a good movie, but there's still another one to be made, I think.
No, I know, and it just speaks a lot that this is the only thing that we have for the most part, right? It says a lot. This is a great story, though. You write that when these women were marching, a throng of, as you mentioned, 100,000 men lined Pennsylvania Avenue, many of them inebriated after inaugural festivals. They heckled, spat, threw objects, and eventually broke through the meager police lines. One newspaper reporter reported that the women practically fought their way by foot up Pennsylvania Avenue. Over 100 women were hospitalized.
And, you know, this is really true. This is in the newspapers, and you can see the New York Times archives. It was a massive amount of publicity. It overshadowed in some ways the attention to the presidential inaugural. The police chief of Washington, D.C. had to resign. And when I talk about this, so many people hear this story and think, wow, that sounds just like Selma. It really was similar in its consequences. And the women's suffrage movement pioneered a lot of the tactics of protest that were used by many others. I mean, this was before Gandhi. This was certainly before the American labor movement had sit-down strikes, and obviously well before the African-American civil rights movement in the 60s and 50s. These young women were real pioneers, and we don't know many of their names. Alice Paul and Lucy Burns and the Brennan Center, which I lead, is at NYU Law School. So my favorite in some ways is a woman named Inez Mulholland, who was a recent NYU Law graduate who would ride a white horse at the head of these suffrage parades dressed as a Greek goddess. So there was one tactic that hasn't been used that much since.
And you write that Inez, an amazing independent woman, in August 1916 here in California, she collapsed during a speech and died a month later. Her last words were, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty?"
And she was a real celebrity. She was the face of the movement in many ways. She was beautiful in the manner of a Gibson girl, which was sort of the popular model of femininity at the time. And she was a journalist. She went to Europe by herself during World War I to cover the war. She was very involved in sort of radical literary circles and activist circles in Greenwich Village. And when she died, her funeral, the people who were organizing the suffrage movement were quite skilled at using what they had. They decided to hold her funeral in the U.S. Capitol. They got the U.S. Capitol for her funeral. And it was, it was kind of a spectacle. And they, at the funeral, wrote up a bunch of demands and resolutions. And they met with President Woodrow Wilson afterwards, and he sort of rudely stormed out on them. And that was when they began picketing the White House. There's definitely a movie to be made of her life, if nothing else. Anybody's listening.
And then before we go to break, Native Americans did not really get the right to vote until 1924. Congress passed the Indian Citizenship Act. In 1956, Utah was the last state to give Native Americans the right to vote.
Native Americans and also have been disenfranchised emphatically throughout our history in so many ways, both their land and their rights. Immigrants. So many of the cities of the North in the late 1800s, it wasn't as bad a voter suppression as happened with the African-American vote in the South. But there were plenty of laws passed to make it harder for immigrants and working class people to vote in the North. Literacy tests were not only aimed at black voters but at non-English speaking voters. Even voter registration, which seems like a sort of obvious thing you have to do, the way it was introduced was to keep the Irish and Catholic vote down and the working class vote. So there was a whole host of rules. Many of them look neutral on their face, just like something like voter ID might today. But the way they were done can have pretty significant consequences in driving down participation and turnout.
And we will talk more about those laws after the break. Today, we are joined by Michael Waldman, the president of the Brennan Center for Justice. He is out with a new book called The Fight to Vote. Michael will be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club at 6:30. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the history of voting, how we got here today, and what will it take to ensure free and fair elections? This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is always better when listeners get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. The email address, if you would prefer to write your question or comment, is feedback@yourcallradio.org. World Have Your Say from the BBC is coming up at 11 o'clock. And following that at noon today, from our friends at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, it's Bina.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable, and we will be discussing the Telecommunications Act. It's the 20th year anniversary of the act. President Bill Clinton signed this act in 1996, and we've seen a lot of changes with media consolidation since then. In 1983, 50 corporations controlled about 90% of the media. Today, it's just six. So how has the concentration of media ownership impacted journalism and media democracy? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, and he's out with a new book called The Fight to Vote. Michael will be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6:30. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about voting in the United States? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before we get to calls, I just wanted to mention something I heard last night from presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders, who was speaking in Washington Square Park in New York. Almost 30,000 people showed up. He said something so simple. Everyone over the age of 18 should have the right to vote, period. Do you think we'll ever get there?
We've gotten closer than we've been in the past. The key reform to that end is to change the way we register voters. We have a system in this country where people have to register themselves, where there's all kinds of difficulties and challenges doing that. There are something like 55 million eligible voters who are not registered.
55 million?
Yet the voting rolls really are filled with error and dead people and all those other problems that people worry about. The single most significant change would be to have universal automatic registration, which would basically the government would take on the responsibility of automatically registering people. There's very encouraging, positive movement toward this all around the country right now. And California has actually been a pioneer. Secretary of State Padilla led a drive to have automatic registration at the DMVs. This could add millions of people to the rolls. Oregon, West Virginia, 2 weeks ago, which is a Republican state, just did it. And it's in the presidential campaign. Interestingly, the best proposal for doing this nationwide is from Hillary Clinton, though she's so much more muted in how she talks about it.
What's her proposal?
Her proposal is that everyone who's 18 is automatically registered by the federal government. And or by the states required by the federal government. And students would be pre-registered. And it basically, it's that same idea. It puts sort of flesh on the bones. It would be a breakthrough. It would be a paradigm shift. And as I say, there's a real movement for it all over the country, even as some other states are imposing new restrictions on who can vote.
What would it take to implement her plan?
The way to do it, the easiest way to do it, is a federal law with money to the states to help them implement it. You could in effect require it or make it so states would have to do it, just as after that Florida fiasco, there was a federal law called the Help America Vote Act, which required states to buy electronic voting machines and gave them money to do it. And first of all, those machines are all about to break. They're old. And so there's a federal proposal for doing this that's about to be released in Congress that could be really exciting.
KQED had a piece last month saying just this. Secretary of State Alex Padilla says voting equipment in all of California's counties is nearing the end of life expectancy. He says he does not want the situation to become as disastrous as it was in Florida. He is pushing for $450 million to replace the current equipment.
He is a real national leader on these issues, perhaps in a way Californians who aren't looking outside their borders might not realize. We're actually very excited to have him come keynote a conference at NYU next month on this stuff. So these electronic voting machines, a lot of people were very worried about them being hackable. But with the right kind of paper records, they're actually better than what came before. You have to be able to audit them. You have to have paper records. That's the good news. And that was a big victory that people had who wanted verified voting, who wanted to make sure that that these systems were secure. The bad news is they're old computers. They're now 15 years old. Our study at the Brennan Center showed that 43 states have voting machines that are 10 years old or older. And I don't know about you, but and a lot of them are even older than that. My 10-year-old laptop doesn't work very well. These machines have zip drives. They have parts that are no longer made, and they're going to start breaking, and we're going to learn about that on election days as the, you know, very well-meaning but not particularly computer proficient volunteers at the polling places have to grapple with what happens with these machines.
And just briefly, there's always been confusion about the paper trail when you vote electronically. It's not that you would get a receipt, right? You would actually see a printout just to make sure that the person you voted for is on that paper, but you wouldn't leave with a receipt.
That's right. And the key is that so that when there are audits or recounts, that you can use the paper ballot as the basis for the recount or as a way to make sure that, hey, wait a minute, this machine seems to have voted
for the other woman,
the wrong person. Yeah, let's check the paper. And that's the best way to do it.
Michael Waldman is author of the new book, The Fight to Vote, and president of the Brennan Center for Justice. We've got a number of calls. Let's hear from Judy in Berkeley. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to go back to Florida for a minute. Well, it's true that if not for the obstruction of voting, Florida would have just won flat out without any, you know, blinking of an eye. It's also true that what settled it was the Supreme Court, not the obstruction of voting. And I think that's very important. They stole the election.
Well, so the decision that the caller is referring to, of course, was Bush v. Gore, which was a 5-4 vote to stop the recount that was finally underway. It is the and that was a decision that was indefensible. In fact, it even in its own text, it didn't try to defend itself. It said this only applies this one time, and it's never been cited since in another Supreme Court ruling. And it was a partisan ruling. It was the Republican appointees who picked the Republican president. Having said that, it was a bit of a crazy situation. It really was a tie in Florida, and there really was almost no way to find out who had actually won. You know, the Constitution does nonetheless have provisions. The basic decision should have been up to the people and the courts of Florida before the Supreme Court swooped in and took that out of the hands of the constitutional provisions. It was one of the worst decisions there was.
What did the recounts tell us?
Well, once they saved all the ballots, and it turns out that if the recount had gone the way Al Gore asked, which was that certain counties would get recounted, Bush would have won. If, however, the recount had gone not as Al Gore had asked, but a full statewide recount, Gore would have won. So it's a little nutty and not something we want to see happen again.
Well, thank you for calling in, Judy. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Hi there. I was wondering if Mr. Waldman had heard of the book Strip and Flip, which was co-authored by Harvey Wasserman, and it addressed specifically what was getting at was his concern about what's going to happen in the 2016 presidential election, particularly with voting rolls getting stripped of people who are on the rolls, like what happened in Florida in 2000, ex-felons, et cetera, and so forth. And the flip is the ability of the electronic voting machines to flip the vote from one candidate to another, like what happened in Ohio in the 2004 election.
It sounds pretty NC-17. I'm not familiar with that book. And the phenomenon of purging the voting rolls, as the caller describes, is very important. It's something that's done at the local level, and there can be a great deal of mischief. On the other hand, you want to have the voter rolls be accurate and complete and not full of duplicate voters or people who shouldn't be there. That's why moving toward automatic and universal registration is the best solution, because it sort of minimizes the chance for that kind of manipulation. As for the voting machines, I actually disagree with the caller. I think there were a lot of problems in Ohio, in particular with not having enough voting machines in urban communities and where students were, so that you had long lines in the black neighborhoods and around colleges like Oberlin or Kenyon in poor communities. And that definitely had an impact on Ohio. But I haven't seen good evidence, and I know we've looked. I don't really think that there's a lot of evidence that the voting machines, you know, took a vote for Kerry and counted them as a vote for Bush. I know people are very concerned about that, but that's not ultimately actually, I think, the real problem there.
Yeah. Well, how do you talk to people, though, who don't trust the system? Because we have seen videos of people pushing one candidate and the other candidate comes up. And then back in 2000 – the 2014, during the Ohio vote, this got a lot of attention. Walden Wally O'Dell, the chair and executive director, executive of Diebold, penned a letter pledging his commitment to, quote, helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to President Bush.
Right.
So people are just angry about this. They don't trust the system. What do you say to them?
Well, that was 2004.
There
was a great deal of progress since then. Again, the way we elect people, the way the system worked before those machines was pretty easy to manipulate and full of error. And the electronic machines were not necessarily worse if they had this paper audit trail. And a lot of them didn't back then in 2004. And there was a great victory won by voting rights activists all over the country to get the systems much more secure so that when you have those kind of paper records and when you have auditing, you're in much better shape. And there are still real problems, but I honestly think that there's not a lot of evidence that I've seen. We've looked. My organization, we had a panel of top computer scientists, and they said, yes, this stuff is insecure, but there's not evidence that it's actually been – that some guy sitting with Karl Rove over his shoulder pushed a button and flipped the election. But you don't want that to be a possibility. This was actually a victory of voting rights activists and voter security activists. And sometimes we always are so used to looking at the glass being half empty. This was one where it was actually filled up a bit.
Thank you for calling, Ruth Ann. Let's go next to Jane in Berkeley. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I just want to question whether or not you're aware of the repression of homeless people's right to vote. When I worked with the homeless in Santa Barbara in the 1980s, homeless people could not register to vote because they didn't have an address. And Roy Hastings with the Legal Defense Center was able to win the homeless the right to vote in California so people could use a tree or a street corner as their address. But even for many years after that court hearing was successfully won, homeless people would try to register or weren't unable to do so because of they were told they didn't have an address.
I'm not familiar with that specific matter that you discussed, but this is the kind of thing over the years where there have been all kinds of vagrancy laws or pauper voting 100 years ago where if you were even getting government assistance, even if it was because you were on strike, you couldn't vote. This is another area where making sure that everybody's registered to vote, it doesn't matter where you live. Right now, it's not only homeless people, but someone who moves from one house to another, they've just unregistered themselves to vote. They think they automatically are changing their voter registration, and they've actually ended their voter registration because their address is no longer valid. If we had a system where people were permanently on the rolls, irrespective of where they lived, that would make a very big difference.
And so that means that your address wouldn't matter.
Or you could update it,
right,
at the polling place. We have so many ways to enfranchise people. It's actually easy to do if we're willing to invest and if we take that right seriously.
Well, give us a few more examples, because we spend so much time talking about voter ID and ending same-day registration, no more registration in high schools. I mean, this just makes no sense. So what else can be done? You said you liked Hillary Clinton's plan to automatically register everyone. You're saying that the one with the address, it wouldn't matter if you moved.
I think that if you had universal voter registration, you could also have electronic poll books at the polling place, so that instead of people coming in and having to sign on a piece of paper, if we had tablets with everyone's information who's registered to vote, their picture would be in there. And if for some reason they didn't have their picture, they could get it snapped on the spot. And New Hampshire is actually experimenting with this. If we treated the customers, voters, the way any company treats their customers, we would have a much better system. Other things that need to happen, we've discussed already, making sure that people who have a past criminal conviction, who are back in the community, who are paying their taxes, are able to get their right to vote restored easily. And another thing that is a big problem all over the country, and you've seen this as one of the key areas of cutback when conservative state legislatures have tried to restrict voting rights, is early voting. Mm. You know, this idea that we only vote on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, that's not in the Constitution. That is a law passed in the 1840s for the convenience of the farmers of the time. And there are so many ways to make it easier for people to vote who are working people, who don't have the ability to wait on long lines. Right now, about a third of Americans vote before Election Day, whether it's by mail-in or absentee or in-person early voting. In-person early voting has been especially used by poor people and people of color. And so suddenly, that's what gets cut back on. There's the day before, the Sunday before Election Day is the day where a lot of black churches have what they call souls to the polls. It's, you know, it's sort of people all go together and vote. And suddenly, somehow, that was seen as suspect. And states from North Carolina to Ohio and all these other places cut back on ended voting on the Sunday before the election. There ought to be, at the very least, a national standard of how many early voting days there are. Now, I say this, I'm coming from New York. We have no early voting. California is well ahead of New York in that respect. New York has, as I was just saying to a journalist today, other states have voter ID. We have Albany. And the political insiders of both parties in Albany are very adept. They're not so good at passing budgets, but they're very good at making sure the laws keep political change from happening.
Oh, I'm glad that you brought up New York and California, because you just reminded me to give information about our primary. For the first time in decades, we might actually matter in California. So the primary is on Tuesday, June 7th. You have to register by May 23rd, and it's confusing. So if you want to vote for a Democrat, you have to be registered as Democrat or decline to state. To make it even more confusing, if you live in San Francisco and you want to vote for the San Francisco's Democratic County Central Committee, you have to be a Democrat. You cannot be declined to state. So if you want to vote in the San Francisco Democratic Council Central Committee contest, you've got to be a Democrat. And then if you want to vote for Republican, same thing at the state level. You've got to be a Republican or declined to state, Libertarian or declined to state, Green or declined to state. We haven't even heard from Jill Stein this election. I mean, in the media.
Those rules are purity itself and clarity itself compared to New York, where you had to have registered a month and a half ago to vote in the primaries at all. And if you want to change your party registration, you had to have done so by last October. Now, it's interesting that the rationale for that, in part, because everyone thinks, oh, that's obviously to keep people from signing up to vote for a favorite candidate. And that's true. But it's also to help the small parties who don't want to have – in New York, there's something called the Working Families Party or other third parties. And they want to be able to run their elections without getting swamped by Democratic or Republican voters basically taking over their parties. So it's these rules are – one of the things I came out of the research for this book feeling much more much more favorable toward political parties than probably a lot of your listeners might expect. Those parties have often been the drivers of expanded democracy and mass mobilization, and sometimes for restricting the vote also.
There's a new study out that didn't get much attention. I found it at a website called The Conversation. And in 2015, there was an election report. It gathered assessments from 2,000 experts to look at the election process in Western democracies. And the United States landed at the very bottom of the list.
Jimmy Carter, you know, the former president, sometimes goes around the world and monitors elections. in other places. And I don't, I may be remembering this wrong, but I think they said, well, they wouldn't have done that in the United States because our rules are too messed up. Look, our we have the oldest democracy in the world. Our Constitution has been in effect for two centuries. The countries that came afterwards that learned how we did it, a lot of them did it somewhat differently. We have this rather convoluted system of representation. To give you one example, we believe in one person, one vote. What that means is everybody's vote should count more or less equally. That's the basis on which, for example, the House of Representatives, Congress, is set up. And just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court reaffirmed the idea of one person, one vote. But we can all think of at least one big exception to one person, one vote, the United States Senate, where it's every state gets two. And so at the time of the Constitution, the biggest state had about four times the population of the smallest state. Now California has 55 million people and Wyoming has less than a million, but they each get two senators. And that dominance of one of the two houses of government has a big, big consequence. Just think about the Supreme Court and the confirmations and the fights we're seeing there.
Michael Waldman is author of The Fight to Vote. I want to get in as many calls as we can. We've got a few minutes left. Let's hear from Kathy in San Francisco. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'll try to be brief. I was wondering if, or I encourage you to look at the QLF website. They brought it down to a science on winning elections in every city, county, and state for the Republicans. And the governor of Arizona was urging all Republicans to use Cumulus Radio, to use their a dialogue, a friendly dialogue to the listeners, to persuade them to win elections the same way Ronald Reagan won California, and that got him to win the presidency. And Ted Cruz has got it down to a science. He's been working on this since childhood with his father on how to win the delegates. And so, you know, we need to raise our kids the same way, to start early on how to win elections. So Cumulus, the last page is extremely racist. It shows a bunch of white men holding rifles and with a American flag above and a red screen over on, like, blood. Like, they're thinking of this election the same way they think about warfare. And it's definitely, they want white win. I'll end there.
I'm not familiar with that website. Ted Cruz's campaign, of the current campaigns, is perhaps the most sophisticated, at least on the Republican side, in using data. There was actually a book about some of the people in Texas called, I believe, the Victory Lab. In the use of micro-targeting, the way businesses do, and the way the Obama campaign did, where they really know voter by voter. It's not in the old days, you know, the way you did get out the vote was you would go to a housing project or you'd go to a neighborhood and you'd sort of want to flush the whole thing out and get everybody out to the polls. Now people know to the person, well, this person seems to subscribe to this magazine and belong to this church, and therefore we think that we can get them to vote on this issue. And Cruz is very sophisticated, and we are seeing him run rings around Donald Trump. It is kind of enjoyable to watch at one level as Trump suddenly disguised. It's like Trump built a casino and only later learned there were zoning laws, you know, that he needed to learn about.
Well, and also we didn't get to spend much time on this, but can we be honest about why these laws are being passed? Just recently, Todd Alba, a Republican staffer in Wisconsin, left the party over the state's voter ID laws. He is accusing a handful of Republican senators of being giddy about the suppression of people of color and college students. And Republican Representative Glenn Grothman was talking about the goal of Wisconsin's voter ID law on a TV station, WTMJ. He said, you know, a lot of Republicans haven't been able to win in Wisconsin. I think Hillary's the weakest candidate out there. But photo ID is going to make a little bit of a difference as well.
And every once in a while, the authors of these laws blurt out the truth. In Pennsylvania, a few years ago, the speaker of the state legislature said that passing voter ID there was going to lead to Governor Romney winning in that election, although that was blocked by the courts. So that didn't at least happen in that way. In Texas, the United States Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. They said it wasn't needed anymore. 2 hours later, the state of Texas implemented its strict, harsh voter ID law. This is a law that said, you, among other things, you cannot use your University of Texas student ID to vote, but you can use your concealed carry gun permit. Very carefully crafted. And, you know, I don't want to blow up your switchboard, but I actually am for voter ID. I think it makes sense for people to have to be who they say they are, and it's not crazy to ask them to prove it. I'm against requiring ID that lots of people don't have. About 11% of eligible voters in the United States, for example, don't have a driver's license or those other kind of specific things. In Texas, this new law instantly, 2 hours after the Supreme Court said it wasn't needed anymore to protect them, 608,000 voters, registered voters, lost their right to vote. And my organization, the Brennan Center for Justice, along with the Justice Department and other voting rights and civil rights groups, we went to court and sued. And a federal court ruled that this was the case, that it was discriminatory, that it was deliberate, and it was unconstitutional. And it was, in fact, upheld by the most conservative federal appeals court in the country. But the law is still on the books because these wheels of justice grind on and on. It's not going to ultimately be the courts that protect us. We all ourselves have to demand of the politicians that they stand up for voting rights and to make those voices and votes really count.
And we should also be clear that in 2014, the Washington Post ran a piece called Seven Papers, Four Government Queries, Two News Investigations, and One Court Ruling Prove That Voter Fraud Is Mostly a Myth.
You are the only kind of voter fraud that these new laws really get at is in-person voter impersonation. You walk in, pretend to be somebody else. You are more likely, as a matter of statistics, to be hit by lightning in the United States than to commit that kind of fraud. There's plenty of potential for misconduct, but it's almost always by the politicians, not the voters.
And, Michael, I have one really important correction. I did not realize that the Republican Party is not going to allow declined-to-state voters to vote for a Republican president in California. So you have to be a Republican if you're going to vote for a Republican presidential candidate. We have to do more shows about this to get this information out there. Michael Waldman is author of The Fight to Vote. He'll be speaking tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6:30. Michael, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and media consolidation. In 1983, 50 corporations controlled almost 90% of the media. Today, just six companies control almost everything we see, hear, and read. So how has the concentration of media ownership impacted journalism and media democracy? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.